Hey there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. This is episode number 384 and our first episode of 2017. Happy New Year, everybody. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line, send an email on over to ken@thisshowissogay.com, stroll on over to thisshowissogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter, the handle is thisshowissogay, and of course, go on over to that Facebook, type in This Show Is So Gay, like us, because we sure as heck like you. Well, because it's the first episode of the year, we made it jam-packed. We have not one, but two guests for you. Let me introduce the first one. Aaron Van Voris is the lead pastor at Central Avenue Church in Glendale, California. He received his Master's of Divinity from Fuller Seminary. He has a new book out called A Survival Guide for Heretics. It's available anywhere fine books are sold, and I think all of you are going to get a ton out of it. Pastor, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Hey, thanks so much, Ken. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Happy New Year to you, sir.
Yeah, you too. Happy 2017.
How did you ring it in?
Really low-key. I was in bed by 9:30.
Okay.
I had to be up the next day for church.
There it is. Now, I would imagine that the first sermon of 2017 was a big one.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Actually, the first sermon of 2017 was about, it was entitled Why I'm Affirming, because this week I'm going to GCN, and so I decided once a year I have to preach that sermon so as to help those in the congregation that are still kind of working through, you know, the theological issues around being affirming of same-sex relationships, and those are kind of new to the church. And so once a year I preach that sermon to kind of acclimate and orientate people towards basically the culture of the church and where I'm at on that issue. So just so happens that that was the first sermon of 2017.
And we'll remind our listeners, GCN, the Gay Christian Network, which we've talked about a ton, we'll talk about in a little bit with you. I love the idea that you had to do a sermon to prepare your congregation for you not being there for a little bit.
Well, it wasn't to prepare them that I wasn't going to be there. It was more about, you know, kind of revisiting that important issue.
Yeah.
Of you know, why I'm affirming and why we're an affirming church. And you know, again, it's a sermon I deliver once a year, and it's usually done right around GCN, which is in January. So you know, it was kind of like a difficult Sunday for me to do anything else because I'm gone the next week, so I don't want to start a new series. I was like, you know what, this is the time of year.
Nice.
that I do this one sermon. So that's what happened.
I'm okay with us starting out the year with a little affirmation.
Yeah, absolutely.
Good stuff. Good stuff. All right. Well, let's go all the way back. When little Aaron was running around the suburbs of Chicago, was this the dream? Was this the career you saw yourself in?
Yes and no. When I was in my teens, I really felt like full-time ministry was for me. I didn't know what capacity. I felt like ministry was for me. I didn't know if I'd have a career in it, but I loved the church. I was in church, you know, I was practically born in a pew. My earliest memories are, you know, climbing underneath the pews in church and going to sleep on my mom's lap and, you know, in church. And so I always felt very drawn to spiritual community and towards ministry. And so, yeah, this was kind of the dream, but I am a far cry away from where I began. And If my former self could get in a time machine, I'm sure my 20-year-old self would come to this 40-year-old self and confront him about how he has gone astray from the Lord. And so it's a far cry from where I used to be and where I grew up.
How do you go about talking about your journey? I mean, people need to pick up the book and they're going to learn a ton about you. But how do you decide, well, how much am I going to share with people out there?
Yeah, that's actually a really good question, and it doesn't have a simple answer. It really has to be kind of intuitive and instinctive, because you know, if you can't make it all, you can't make ministry and preaching all about you. If you're constantly just talking about yourself up there, that's a problem. But as far as how much to share, I'm kind of an open book, honestly. Like, I err on the side of sharing too much, probably, because I feel like our stories are everything. And so the more story, the more personal story you can include, you know, in your relationships and even in your sermons, the better, as long as it's not like overkill and you make it all about you.
Yeah, nice. Well, tell everybody about the Central Avenue Church there in Glendale, California.
Yeah, well, Central is a bit of an enigma or a strange phenomena in that we are an affirming congregation, but non-denominational. So, you know, in my understanding, most affirming churches are of high church traditions like the Episcopals, the Methodists. We are a committed Christian church, but we are independent. We are not affiliated with any denomination. But we became affirming as a result of, gosh, this is such a long story, such a complicated story in some ways. But the church was planted and built as a Southern Baptist congregation in 1959, and it had dwindled down in size to about 20 people on Sunday mornings, such that they were getting ready to close their doors in 2009 when they went shopping for a new pastor. I was coming out of seminary, Fuller in Pasadena, which is adjacent to Glendale, which is where the church is located. And so I found on the Fuller website their advertisement that they're looking for a new pastor. And so I was feeling like this could be an incredible opportunity. I'll check it out. They'll take the interview. And one thing led to another. In November of 2009, I got the job at this dying church, this dying Southern Baptist church. I mean, it was in a deep freeze. It was 1955 in there. They hadn't changed anything really in, wow, you know, 50 plus years. But I was hired with the mandate to come in and change everything. That's why I took the job. I did not grow up Southern Baptist. I grew up Pentecostal, but had gotten away from my fundamentalist roots in the 2000s and was really looking for something different. I was thinking about completely getting out of ministry and just going into academia and being like a seminary professor, perhaps. But I still had a heart for the church, and this opportunity seemed too good to pass up. And so I took the job with the mandate to come in and change everything, to change the name, change the worship style, change the aesthetics of the building, the vision, the direction, everything. And so in 2010, we changed the name from First Southern Baptist Church of Glendale to Central Avenue Church and cut our ties with the Southern Baptists officially, went non-denom. And I took the job actually with the vision to make it into an intellectually honest Christian community. And what that means is that I wanted to be the pastor of a church that really was honest about life and about things like science and didn't hide from the truth, but kind of embraced unknowing and mystery and didn't try to provide simple answers to life's toughest questions, but kind of would learn to live in the tension of them and maybe find a way to articulate Christianity in that. I was convinced that we so need churches that are radically honest, that are, again, just very open to science and to other perspectives, both within the Christian tradition and outside. And I really wanted to build such a sensitive, open-minded community. And so that's kind of how it got started. And here it is, 2017, and we've grown, and we've changed a lot.
By the way, haven't you not only grown, haven't you like tripled in size?
Yeah, well, the original crew that we had was about 25, and yeah, the average age of that crew was about, I'd say, 60-something. I'll give you kind of like the brief story. They all left within 2 years of me being there. You know, the crew that hired me, they were kind of conservative, but wanting to change a little bit. They just weren't sure how much, and they got discouraged. They thought they were going to hire this pastor right out of seminary. They changed the worship style from an organ on Sunday mornings with an open hymnal to a worship band. They changed the name of the church to something, you know, more progressive or open, like just Central Avenue Church. They thought the church was going to explode. They thought it'd go from 25 to 205 within like a couple of years. Well, what happened was we went from 25 to 45, and they got discouraged, and they started questioning, you know, my vision and saying, hey, there must be something wrong with your preaching. Why aren't we growing? Oh, there must be something wrong with Max's worship directing, you know, yada, yada, yada. And they all just started to leave. And so within about 2 years of me being there, I had lost all the original crew. But during that time, new people started coming in, people with a pioneering spirit, people in their 20s and 30s that really caught the vision and decided this was something they wanted to help build, this intellectually honest kind of radical Christian community. And so it was kind of the best thing that ever happened, because that original crew left, and so my handlers left, and sort of the cancerous part of the church left. And even though those folks were great to some capacity, they hired me and supported me early on, they they actually became kind of cancerous. They were withholding most of the church's money from us, lying about different bank accounts because they wanted to potentially fire me and restart the church with, you know, some seed money. It was ugly early on. It was hard, yeah. But it was worth enduring. And what we got was a church now of about 150 people call Central home. There's probably about 90 regular attenders every week. That's kind of how church runs. So I guess you could say we've more than tripled itself.
Yeah. Now, let's get right to it. You're appearing right now on This Show Is So Gay, and I think that there are any number of listeners who are hearing some of these words like fundamentalist and Baptist and possibly even church and thinking, well, that's at odds with sexual orientation. Maybe we have listeners who have felt excluded in their past, or, you know, occasionally, which always entertains me, we have people listening in just to send me some sort of nasty email, so they're thinking, oh, okay, these two are at odds and should be. How do we start reconciling these two things, you know, this impression of faith and an individual sexual orientation, which I have to say, you know, 8 years of doing this show, I do know these two things should not be at odds.
Right. Yes, absolutely. So how do we start reconciling them? In my experience, it is a process of recovery for a lot of us. A lot of your listeners, a lot of people in my church, including myself, came out of very conservative Christian traditions, meaning they come out of traditions that tell them that, you know, gay people are going to hell, gay people, you know, lesbian, gay, bisexual, trans, queer, intersex. We didn't have that kind of vocabulary growing up, but the idea was that quote unquote gay people, right, because it was sort of a catch-all,
right.
that they have to be set free. I was raised being told that gay people are demon-possessed. And it took me years to kind of, that the word would be detox, or to kind of detrain my brain, relearn kind of the gospel and this idea that Christianity is fundamentally about radical love, radical inclusion, this idea of scandalous grace. I love Rachel Held Evans' quote, that the gospel is scandalous not because of who it keeps out, but because of who it lets in. This is the radical love of Christ, this prophet, this man, this savior, that spent all of his time with the social, religious, and sexual outcasts, you know, showing them that they too are included in the kingdom of God. You know, this is Christianity, and you have to unlearn so much of this kind of tribalism we grew up in order to get there. So, you know, the first step, Ken, is really detox. It's really about unlearning a lot of the abusive, oppressive, and violent ideologies we were raised in, and redefining the gospel. And I don't mean that in a way like, hey, we're making this up new. It's about getting down to the roots of what the gospel is about and originally was about, and why Jesus was so scandalous in his day and time. That's really where it begins and where it ends.
Yeah. Now, you are ever in the pursuit of creating an inclusive congregation. Let's go to the flip side. If you do have someone new to the congregation who espouses anti-gay, any type of ideology, how do you go about working with that congregant?
Yeah, you know, I think it comes down to personal conversations. Honestly, I walk them through kind of what I just talked about and ask them a lot of questions. It's extremely non-judgmental. I have a lot of sympathy for those folks because I used to be one. I used to be someone that condemned lesbian, gay folks. So I understand where they're coming from. But honestly, it comes down to just doing your best to love them, speak to them in non-judgmental ways, but be very clear that, you know, I think what you're espousing is wrong, and here's why. Here's my understanding of the gospel. Here's my understanding of you know, what it means to really be loving. Yeah, that's kind of what I do.
That's a good start. Again, listeners, we are here with Aaron Van Voorhis, the lead pastor at Central Avenue Church. Aaron, I don't know if you know this, you wrote a book, sir.
Yes, I did.
That's pretty exciting.
You're the one who read it, apparently.
Talk to me about how you go about just putting your thoughts down on paper. What was the guiding motivation for putting this book together?
The guiding motivation really was being the pastor of this community that is struggling with all of these ideas, and my own personal journey of coming out of fundamentalism, sort of a conservative Christianity, and into a more progressive faith. It really was the product of 15 years of my life going through this transition. And it's not to say that I've arrived now, that I'm in this place of, you know, static purity, like I don't have anywhere else to go or something like that. But it is about the journey from there, at least, to here and where I'm at now. So, yeah, I mean, that's kind of how it came to fruition.
Yeah. Do you feel good about what's out there? You should feel very good. I'm telling you that's the answer, but I still should probably check in with you.
Yeah. You mean the book itself?
Yes.
I feel great about it. I do ask myself, well, 10 years from now, am I still going to feel that way? Am I going to look at this and be like, am I still proud of this? You know, is this still who I am? And I don't mind telling you my age. I think I already did. I'm 40. So I feel like I've lived enough to write a book, I guess. I'm really glad I didn't write this in my 20s. I was thinking about writing a similar book even 15 years ago, maybe 10 years ago. I'm so glad I didn't do that because I was so in a different place then. I was kind of halfway to where I'm at now. This book, I think, really is a work of maturity for me and a very long path that has led me to this place.
I would imagine some of your older congregants, anytime you use the phrase radical theology, they stop and say, "Ugh, these young kids and their ideas."
Right. Yeah. I don't have very many older congregants. I have two gentlemen in my congregation that are older than 70, but the average age of my church is early 30s.
Wow. That's a whole different energy.
Oh, absolutely.
Talk to our listeners more about radical theology and what we need to know about it to move forward. And of course, don't tell them too much because we want everyone to buy your book.
Oh, of course. No, there's so much to unpack. Radical theology is essentially a movement. It's not even so much of a theology as it is just a way of critiquing religion, being radically honest. In fact, radical theology should just be called radical honesty. It's not really a theology. We shouldn't confuse it with some kind of new confessional theology, some kind of new denomination, some kind of new doctrine or dogma. It's not that. It's really about, it pulls on the tools of postmodern philosophy and psychoanalysis as simply ways of uncovering the way that we kind of unconsciously live in the world, the way that belief often functions for us. So it's a way of getting to the bottom of belief, a way of getting to the bottom of why we do what we do, why we think what we think, why we believe what we believe, and getting really honest about who we are as people and who we are as Christians. So again, radical theology is the term that's used in this movement that I'm a part of both scholars and practitioners, meaning academics and pastors that are kind of moving in this direction of trying to really articulate the gospel and Christianity and this idea of God in a very honest and real way. I know that's very complicated what I'm saying. I'm saying a lot there, but again, just think of radical theology as being primarily about radical honesty, really, really getting honest about who we are.
That can be pretty mind-altering for folks.
It absolutely is, because let's be honest, we function as human beings so much in the unconscious. You know, belief itself is such a powerful kind of unconscious mechanism, the way it functions for so many of us. People are drawn to religion, they're drawn to church, primarily because, you know, we all sense, you know, this feeling of chaos, this feeling that, you know, we're not in control of our lives, that you know, life is perhaps meaningless. We are concerned about death. We feel this sense, this need for mastery over death, this need for fulfillment, this need for a sense of satisfaction in our lives. You know, whoever we are, wherever we are, you know, all human beings hunger for these things. And religion and church comes along, like a lot of things in life, and provides a set of answers. It says, essentially, you know, believe this, think that, come to this church, read this Bible, tithe, live this way, and God's going to make good things happen for you. You know, you're going to have a pretty good life now, and you're going to have everlasting life in heaven. And so, you know, we hunger for such answers. We really do. And honestly, the way that religion and church often function and the way those answers often function is a way of covering up the truth of our lives, that ultimately we're immersed in mystery and unknowing. We don't have the answers. We don't know if there's a God. We don't know if there's an afterlife. Nobody does. And And that terrifies us. And so the trick, and here's kind of like the catch or the trick with radical theology, it's really about, it's like AA. It's about being really honest about your brokenness and about the facts of life and making peace with that so that you can have some healing. Think of radical theology and this project as being a lot like AA, in that when you first go to AA, the first thing you do is you say, hi, my name's Aaron and I'm an addict. And everyone says, hi, Aaron, welcome. And it's in that atmosphere of radical honesty with your brokenness and in that that atmosphere of inclusion and acceptance without judgment that we suddenly can find some healing. We can suddenly learn to be okay not being okay. Does that make sense?
It does. And it strikes me, you know, because I have you on the phone, I can get some free spiritual counseling, which is great for me because, you know, you're all the way on the other side of the country. I'm a gay Jew. My partner is in seminary. And so he is in semester 2 of 6 of his master's in divinity. And these are conversations that often come up of finding that middle ground. And you do address this concept of skepticism. And I think that that's a really important piece. Actually, I think for some people, if we talk about skepticism and what we're unsure of, that can be this place where people just stop and say, okay, I can't continue this conversation because it's so overwhelming. Whereas I think you present it in a way that actually can be common ground for people of many different faiths.
Absolutely. Yes. Radical theology, again, is about radical honesty. And it crosses all religious, tribal, and belief boundaries. It really is about the human condition and the way that we human beings, be we Jew, Christian, Muslim, Buddhist, whatever, often use theology and religion to cover up the terrible truth of our life, that we're immersed in mystery and unknowing, where we're scared of death, we're terrified of the unknown. And we crave meaning, we crave fulfillment, and we look to various things, not just religion, but if you look at advertisements, just driving down the road and looking at billboards, you know, every advertisement is ultimately, you know, selling fulfillment, happiness, you know, drink this beer, buy this car, and you're going to be beautiful and fulfilled and happy. You know, the same thing is happening in church. Just, you know, God is the product, the pastor is the salesman. The church is the showroom floor. The worship songs are the jingles. You know, it's God that's being sold to provide meaning and fulfillment and joy instead of a Mercedes-Benz. But, you know, it's the same kind of concept. We want something to numb us and help us cover up the fact that we are terrified, that we are immersed in mystery and unknowing, that we crave meaning and fulfillment. And the trick is to embrace those things, to acknowledge those things about ourselves. And Christianity, and this is what's so powerful for me about this whole project, is that Christianity is fundamentally about embracing death, embracing the truth of our lives, embrace it, which is what the cross represents, the death of God, the death of these meaning-making systems, and experiencing as a result of embracing that death a resurrection, being born again in the world, where suddenly God is found in the simple act of love itself. Joy and peace and fulfillment is found in loving relationship and giving ourselves completely over to life in the world rather than setting our eyes on heaven, you know, praying that heaven comes to earth, praying your kingdom come, your will be done on earth. You know, this idea of merging heaven and earth. This is the incarnation. This is the gospel. This is radical theology. This idea of finding God in the midst of our lives, in all the brokenness and the mess, finding Christ, finding God in the midst of this, finding depth in the midst of this. That is healing. That is enriching. So yeah, that's the project, Ken. That's really what it's about.
Exciting stuff. Again, a survival guide to heretics. It's available on Amazon, anywhere fine books are sold. Let's weave sexual orientation back into this. What would you have to say to all of the spiritual leaders out there who really don't have as affirming of a congregation as they could possibly have? And I would think that they would bear some responsibility for that.
Yes, they do. And it's tough for them. You know, I'm sympathetic to them as a fellow pastor. A lot of them are in a position whereby behind closed doors, they will tell you, I'm affirming. I really want to come out and embrace the LGBT community in my church, but I will lose my job. I will lose my livelihood if I do. You know, in some ways I'm sympathetic to that, but in other ways I'm not, because you know, the bottom line is these people are suffering and dying in society and in the church. I mean, you know, going to GCN year after year, I hear countless stories of people who have tried to commit suicide, who have been in therapy for depression, who have anxiety, you know, maladies, autoimmune diseases that they've picked up from being told their whole life that they're evil, they're disgusting, God thinks they're an abomination, yada, yada, yada. And these pastors are basically letting them die in the margins, letting them, you know, be kicked out of their churches and out of their families because they want to maintain their livelihood. That is deeply problematic to me. And, yeah. and that needs to be said, that you know, if you're not willing to stand up for the marginalized, for the oppressed as a pastor, I don't know what you're doing. And so, you know, again, I get the need to, you know, the desire to keep your job, you know, but we've got to be finding ways as pastors to bring our community along and make them into safer places. The ideal situation would be to turn every church into completely 100% affirming, but that's just not possible for a lot of churches. It takes years to do that. What I would tell pastors is be working constantly and consciously within your community to make it into a safer place. Even if you can't take it 100% of the way there in the next 5 to 10 years, just work on constantly making it safer and more welcoming and loving towards the LGBT community.
There it is. There it is. All right, listeners, this is what we need you to go do. You, of course, need to go pick up a copy of A Survival Guide for Heretics. I didn't even ask Aaron the question of will the church survive, because I think we could do a whole nother hour on that one. But you can pick up the book and learn more about that. You can, of course, learn more about Aaron. Stroll on over to aaronvanvoorhis.com. That's AaronVanVoorhis.com. You're headed off to the Gay Christian Network Conference. What are you hoping to get out of it, sir?
You know, just further relationship building experiences with gay Christians and learning from their stories. The theme this year is personal stories, and so I'm looking forward to hearing more people's stories and interacting with them and just networking and getting to know hopefully some more pastors and leaders that of affirming churches. There's not many of us out there, and so you know, I enjoy going to GCN and meeting some of those folks, too.
Awesome. You're doing pretty important work, sir.
Yeah, thanks, Ken. So are you.
So
we're all in this together.
We are all in this together. I have to tell you, I do love having these conversations. Faith, I think, is one of those topics that we often stay away from, and in particular at that crowded intersection of faith and sexual orientation. We certainly could have pulled race into this as well, but again, we'll have you back. We'll talk all about that. But it's really important that you are not shying away from this, and you are engaging us in a much different way. And that's important stuff, and I know your congregants appreciate it, and I'm sure our listeners do as well.
Thank you so much, Ken.
All right, folks, and we are back with our second amazing guest of this first episode of 2017. Let me introduce him to you. Jared Milrad is an award-winning actor, writer, producer, lawyer, consultant, and entrepreneur. Jared has an unbelievably eclectic resume, which includes working in the White House for President Barack Obama, founding a nationally recognized nonprofit organization, and appearing in Hillary Clinton's historic presidential campaign commercials. Jared has produced several creative projects, including his first book, which we're going to talk all about, So You Want to Get Gay Married, Stuff You Need to Know Before Saying I Do, which is available right this very second. He has acted in, written, and produced a short film called Office Party, as well as the web series Hurry Up and Wait, and he is the star of the award-winning documentary Jared and Nate, A Love Story. Jared co-produced and was a featured speaker at the launch of Storytellers United, an innovative salon series inspiring inclusivity and sensitivity in entertainment, and he is the founder of We Won't Go Back, a people's movement for Americans of all backgrounds, building a more inclusive and hopeful future. Right this second, he is here with us. Jared, welcome to this show, It's So Gay.
Thanks so much, Ken. Happy to be here.
My fear is that you are not sleeping enough.
You know, I've gotten that concern from the Smith family, from those of my life. So I'm hanging in there so far. I appreciate the thought.
All right. I like when everyone is healthy and well-rested, but I would imagine that your family is constantly saying, so what is it that Jared does? Is there one word that really encapsulates what it is that you do?
No, I don't think there is a word. I'm an eclectic, which I think you captured well. But yeah, I tend to be, I think it's part of the theme of my life going back to my probably early teen years. I've been doing multiple careers at one time, which can be both good and challenging, as you can imagine.
I thought the dream was to become a veterinarian. What happened to that?
Yeah, good question. So I was really from my earliest memories, I was infatuated with wildlife, animals, and loved rescuing birds and various wildlife, and even in New York City where I grew up, in New Jersey. But by the time I got to really halfway through college, started to get more involved in not only in activism for animal rights, but also environmental issues and human rights and sort of a whole slew of political issues related to that. And then started working for a guy named Barack Obama, who ended up becoming president. So that by the time I was finishing my grad degree at Tufts University, which actually led me to get accepted into veterinary school, folks were just saying, what are you doing? Why would you spend 4 years and lots of money on a veterinary degree when you could you clearly have lots of other interests going on?
But if President Obama called you today and said, you know what, Jared, I really do need you to become a veterinarian, would you still consider it?
You know, I mean, if he called, maybe I'd consider it.
All right. It's a call to service. Yeah. Well, we have to talk about those Hillary commercials. How did those even come about that you and your partner ended up in those commercials?
It's pretty funny. So so I'd worked, obviously, for President Obama twice, so both presidential campaigns in 2008 and 2012. And so I'd known a fair amount of folks involved with his campaigns and had a friend who knew his 2012 campaign videographer very well. There's actually, a lot of people don't know this, but there's usually one or two people that sort of follow around a presidential candidate and document all their campaigning. And so we had been connected to that person a few months before we were getting married, because our friend had said, hey, as you know, Hillary Clinton might run for president. We're not, we can't share much more than that, but they're doing this video about folks undergoing, quote, big life changes, end quote. So, it was good timing in a sense, and we did an interview mostly talking about our relationship, talking about LGBT equality, talking about how we met, a little bit about why we supported Hillary and her potential run for president, but it turned out that we were, in her launch video, which we found out while we were shopping for wedding invitations and wedding clothes downtown Chicago. So it was a bit of a surprise, but it turned out to be, I think, a really good thing, just given all the well wishes we heard from around the world, particularly LGBTQ youth who were inspired by this story of getting married and being open and proud of who we were.
In my head, you remember exactly where you were when you watched it the first time.
Yeah, absolutely. And we actually, it's pretty funny. We were literally in the process of trying on clothes that we were thinking of getting for our wedding. Started getting texts and emails and Twitter notifications from friends and friends of friends, so they saw us on CNN and, thought we looked great and congratulations, and we had no idea what we were talking about. So actually, both of us watched the video as we were leaving. I think we were in, J. Crew or Express, or we were in the mall. So, it was pretty funny. It was a pretty sort of classic where were you experience, and we went straight home, and the interviews, started pretty quickly and kind of kept going for the next couple of weeks.
Yeah. Now, I watched it this morning. I watched her launch video getting started this morning, and I haven't watched it since I first saw it, however long ago, over a year ago. It inspired a lot of emotions in me that I very much struggled with. I don't know the last time you've seen it, but what do you do with all of that now? Were you to watch it again, how would you wrap your mind around the emotions that it evokes now?
Yeah, I think it is complicated, emotionally for a lot of us. There's obviously a lot of hope and expectation and optimism wrapped up in that video, which, frankly, we were really inspired by and felt really proud to be a part of, just to see, everyday Americans, which really the video, I think, encapsulated well. You saw, small business owners, you saw Latino Americans. So it was, I think, a really, really diverse portrayal of the country and the best hopes of the country. You know, I think it's still a reminder of what we should be fighting for. It's one of the reasons I launched my campaign, We Won't Go Back, after the election. For me, it's all about taking action and rejuvenating and re-energizing that spirit that the Hillary Clinton launch video captured. And I think it's very emblematic of the so-called, you know, Obama coalition, or you know, folks who really, like us, you know, many young folks who got behind President Obama from the very, very beginning, because we were optimistic and hopeful about the country's what we call and what we hope will be an inclusive, you know, positive future. So, you know, I think at the end of the day, we need to get back in the field, get back out there, and keep fighting for what we believe in. So.
Yeah. You mentioned We Won't Go Back, and we have to talk about that. Well, what I love about that work is it's not just, all right, so what we should do is all go to therapy and talk about our feelings, which we should, because I'm a big fan of everyone feeling very stable and supported. But at the same time, this is very much action-oriented as well, is it not?
It really is. I mean, that would be one of the themes of my work and my life's work is, you know, finding a way to bring action and to bring, you know, movement, if you will. You know, there's a governor I used to work for and volunteer for named Deval Patrick in Massachusetts.
Of course.
He's now a former governor. Yeah, and admire quite a bit. And he has a saying that his grandmother used to tell him, which is, you know, you should pray. You should pray a lot, but you should also move your feet. And, you know, you should also, you should reflect, you should think, but then you should get to work. And so that's really what We Won't Go Back is about. It's an inclusive campaign for Americans of all backgrounds who are really dedicated to this hopeful future, an inclusive future, of just saying that, you know, we all belong. We're not going to go back to a time when there was, you know, rampant open discrimination against women, against the LGBT community, against, you know, folks of color, against immigrants. You know, we really want to fight for the best values that, you know, President Obama and others over the last decade or so have brought forward. So, you know, it's been going really well. We did launch a video that we just released a few weeks ago of really just a diverse portrait of young Americans, particularly diverse Americans. We had, you know, a few Muslim American and Mexican American, you know, LGBT folks. So it was just really a way to say, you know, we're not going back to a time that I think Donald Trump is proposing we go back to in many ways, that we're going to keep fighting for what we believe in and keep moving forward.
Where do you tell people to start? You know, we get emails every week or social media messages just saying, it's just so overwhelming. Where could someone even start to start channeling this energy into action?
You know, one thing you can do, you can call your congressman, and you can also go visit them in person. Now is a good time during the holidays and even a little bit after the holidays while there's still a congressional recess. You can actually go visit your district office, so your member of Congress, request a meeting with them, request a meeting with their top staffers, talk to them about the issues you care about, you know, if that's immigration reform, if it's protecting health care, protecting women's rights, you can go ahead and demand that meeting. Also, calling is really effective. We've heard, you know, now the last few weeks from, and, you know, myself having my first work really after college was interning in the U.S. Senate, so I know this firsthand. When we get a call in Congress, it has a really big impact. You hear the person. You hear their concerns, and you actually, most offices, if they're doing their jobs, they write that down, they report it and record it, and tell the higher-up staffers. So those are a few things. You can also obviously donate to and support the nonprofit organizations that will now be taking, you know, a hit and really need our support, like Planned Parenthood and Human Rights Campaign, American Civil Liberties Union, and many, many others that we list on our site. You know, and you can just really just start to get more engaged. I think Michael Moore had this great point about, you know, just forming a group locally. You know, think about 8 to 10 friends or neighbors that you know, get together once a week, which I've done over the past 2 weeks, and call your member of Congress, you know, write letters, you know, go to the district office, donate to organizations you support. So I think hopefully it'll be a rejuvenation, a test of what our democracy is capable of if we start getting more activated.
And we should also highlight, and I know this is extraordinarily trite and simplistic, but it also feels really good to take action. I mean, the venting is great, and I hope everybody has their confidence and they can just go off about everything that's happening in the news, but taking action actually feels good.
It really does. You know, it's okay for it to be a little bit selfish. You know, anytime I've done public service, anytime I've worked, you know, working for the president's campaigns, they're the most meaningful experiences of my life, really, in a professional context. So, yeah, I mean, I think doing something good for not only for yourself, but something that's bigger than yourself, something that's good for the country, good for folks maybe who can't speak for themselves. You know, one thing that, again, a good thing that's coming out of the election is a lot of us who are, you know, a little bit more, have a little more power, you know, maybe who aren't, you know, say an undocumented immigrant or a dreamer or someone who's very low income and very vulnerable, you know, we have a little bit more power, a little more privilege. And so we have to use that power and privilege in a positive way and really make an impact as much as we can. You know, as Hillary Clinton said, which I totally agree with, you know, that old Methodist creed of doing as good as you can for as long as you can for as many people as you can, I think that bears true now more than ever.
Very much so. Very much so. Again, listeners, we are here with Jared Milorad, award-winning actor, writer, producer, lawyer, consultant, entrepreneur, change maker. Let's talk about the book. The book is called So You Want to Get Gay Married, Stuff You Need to Know Before Saying I Do. Now, I don't know if you know this, Jared, but yours is not the only name on the front of that book.
Yeah, I heard that. I heard that. Yeah, there's a co-author around there, I think. Yeah.
What is it like to work with a co-author to whom you are also married?
It's a fascinating experience. This is a good word to use. It was overall really positive. To be honest, you know, we detail in sort of detail in the book. You know, we've had our fair share of disagreements, but like any couple. But you know, writing the book was one of the less argumentative or intense things we've done. What was great is sort of we kind of fell into our natural niches in terms of this project. So I actually spent a lot of time on the writing side. I've been, you know, writing creatively most of my life. And Nate was great about coming in as, you know, being the practical Midwesterner, as we call him. He came in and really structured the book. So he thought about, okay, this is what the titles we want to do section. He did a good job with editing and kind of putting it all together. So you know, I think overall it worked out pretty well, but we'll see what the readers think. But I think we're still living together, so I guess got some answers about it.
Can we perhaps set a higher barometer than the fact that you're still living together after the book? Let's go for just something more. I don't know. I like the idea that maybe this even brought you closer together.
You know, that's a good one. That's a good idea. No, I think it has. I mean, what was interesting about, and one of the reasons we wanted to write the book together was, you know, being part of Hillary Clinton's campaign brought us in many ways closer together, actually. And it was kind of good timing. It was right before we were planning to get married. And then when we got married, we got, you know, we were doing press interviews for some local news stations literally right before we walked down the aisle. So, you know, maybe it did bring us together. I think it sort of fortified the union that we've built, the life we've built together. Yeah, I think just the notion of telling our story, hopefully inspiring some people along the way, is a process that, you know, maybe not every couple feels through, but I think overall it worked out pretty well. Yeah, we're still married and happily married. So
nice. All right. Let's do the front end and the back end of this process. First, why should, on the front end, why should people pick up this book?
I think it's a unique perspective on not only same-sex couples and you know, same-sex married couples, obviously, but also just on the process that one could take in thinking about getting married and thinking about making that commitment. It's a very, you know, we think of it as a pretty witty, light, comical take on that. You know, the book's really thought of and it's sort of broken down as a self-help book, if you will, into approximately 12 chapters of, you know, hey, this is what you need to think about if you're, you know, going to be adopting dogs like we do. You're going to be thinking about having kids. You're going to be thinking about, you know, changing careers a couple of times, which we've done, moving around the country. So in some ways it's based and rooted in our own story, but I think it's also helpful for folks who are just maybe in those early stages of a relationship or thinking about marriage down the road, whether, you know, same sex or opposite sex. I think it's relatable to a lot of folks, hopefully, and just, you know, really a light, fun read. You know, the folks who we've gotten feedback from have said, you know, read it on an airplane or read it, you know, on the way to work or, you know, like putting on a train. So I think it's hopefully just that kind of read where you just hopefully bring some laughs and smiles and, you know, maybe a couple of tears along the way and to brighten up your day a little bit.
Now, you will not be there when each individual finishes the book. That would be creepy. We've established that before on the show. But were you to be there and you were to supply the thought as soon as they close that book, what's the first thought that you want someone to have as soon as they finish?
Ultimately, optimism, you know, about relationships, about the prospects for, particularly for younger couples, you know, that if you communicate, if you really share those core values, if you are able to fight through some of the struggles that, you know, inevitably we all have in relationships, that at the end of the day, things can go pretty well. And, you know, and that's a good thing that we don't have to. I know a lot of times our news and our media reinforces this sort of doom and gloom aspect of our lives, but I think, you know, hopefully the book leaves people with ultimately a good feeling at the end of the day.
Nice. Now, as a guy who grew up in northern New Jersey and New York City and partnered with a Midwestern gentleman, what advice do you have for me? I feel like you are uniquely positioned to lend stability to my life.
I agree. Yeah. So you have some similarities. I think it's being willing. Sometimes, speaking for the gay Jews of the world, which you might relate to.
Yes.
I think it's being patient. You know, I think it's learning a little bit of patience. We are not known, or my family, speaking for my family, we're not known for being the most calm, if you will, with our opinions and perspectives on the world. And we tend to be, at least, especially me, I tend to be pretty idealistic, if you can't tell, and pretty much a dreamer. So I think being a little bit patient and supportive.
And it looks like that you place some value on some non-traditional vacations as well.
Yeah, we really do. And we talk about a few of them in the book. One of them, of course, is when we went to Colombia on a vacation a few years ago. We wanted to get away from the Chicago winter, and we were just in near Cartagena for a few days and on a beach. And of course, again, being my restless mind, there are a couple puppies that were abandoned. They're basically living at this hotel, which is sort of no floors, the beach floor, literally right on the Caribbean Ocean. And we, the day we were leaving, one of the puppies in particular was very sick. And so going back to my veterinarian background, I essentially told Nate that I'm taking these dogs back to the U.S. He was just, I think he said no probably four times until I convinced him. And thanks to an assist from JetBlue, was able to somehow get them on the plane. But it took us, as we detail in the book, it took us about 3 hours, 3 hours of really intense maneuvering at the Cartagena airport.
I love it. We were thinking about just going to Pittsburgh. That's a whole different option that you presented to us.
Yeah, that's another option. If you want a little more thrill, and you have a couple hours before an international flight, you should definitely have, two puppies in your arms.
See, clearly you haven't been to Pittsburgh lately. There are thrills there on behalf of the Pittsburgh
right.
Tourism Bureau. There's exciting things happening there. Well, what is coming up for you that you're excited about?
Yeah, I mean, a few things. We're releasing a short film called Office Party, which you mentioned. In a few weeks, we'll be releasing online, many film festivals, and hopefully working with some nonprofits. Yeah, hopefully lots more up ahead. I'm hoping to do some more writing. Yeah, lots up ahead. Maybe a couple more books down the road. We'll see how 2017 pans out.
Coming up soon. And I also must say, it makes me feel a little bit better that I'm not the only one who has missed certain events because I've adopted animals by the side of the road.
I think I'm probably at like six dogs right now. It's pretty bad. Plus a bunch of cats when I was in high school. So yeah, it's been, and an array of other animals, I'm sure, somewhere along the line. So it can lead you astray, if you will. Unintended.
I hate ending on such a pun, and yet there we are. Listeners, this is what you guys need to go do. You can stroll on over to anywhere fine books are sold and pick up a copy of So You Want to Get Gay Married, Stuff You Need to Know Before Saying I Do. Just so much fun to read that, so everybody needs to check that out. You must go to wewon'tgoback.us, and you'll learn all about this initiative and take action, because again, we feel great when we take action. And where can they go, Jared, to learn more about you and all the work you're doing?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You can get to jaredmilrad.com. You can find me on Twitter at jaredmilrad, facebook.com/jaredmilrad, Snapchat occasionally, and Instagram relatively often. So I'm all those places.
There it is. Jared, you are the very definition of a Renaissance man. You are inspiring us to take action as you dip your toe in so many different waters and get us moving. So I thank you for all of that, sir.
Thank you, Ken. Thanks for the chat. It sounds like we align on a couple of things, so good to talk.
All right, folks, and we are back. Well, we still have a little time left on this week's episode, so let's get to some of the latest LGBTQ news that's out there. Let's start with the great state of Texas. Texas could soon have its own controversial anti-LGBT bathroom bill. State Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, who He's not so much a supporter of the LGBTQ community, not at all. State Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick has said moves to introduce such a bill, as has proven catastrophic to states like North Carolina, well, those moves will be a priority in the new Texas legislative session. A bill, and again, this is the same type of bill that caused North Carolina to lose billions of dollars in business and sporting events and music events and conferences. The goal is to stop transgender Texans from using any bathroom which does not correspond to the gender stated on their birth certificate. Despite being called a priority by Lieutenant Governor Patrick, a bill could threaten to split the Republican Party, which controls the three branches of government in Texas. The business aspect is likely to prove difficult for some legislators, the Chamber of Commerce, and the Texas Association of Business. I mean, that's one of the things that we saw in North Carolina. I mean, it's horrible what's happening there, and they still have not repealed this bill, but at least is a clarion call to states across the country, sure, you can do this. Here will be the effects. So if you want to make this a priority, then you are telling your business community you are not a priority. You will take a backseat, business community, to what we think is right. And this is radio, so you can't see me putting the word right in quotation marks. So what a stupid mistake this would be, Texas. Sorry, I don't really have something more academic to say about it other than that. This would be a horrible mistake. It will cost you billions of dollars. Probably more for you, Texas, because you have many more billions of dollars to lose. So we will, of course, keep our eyes on that. A famed gospel singer, I know a lot of you heard about this, a famed gospel singer who was set to perform with Pharrell Williams on The Ellen Show this week has responded to criticism following a homophobic rant. In a church sermon last week, pastor and singer Kim Burrell, who features on Pharrell's track I See a Victory, well, pastor and singer Kim Burrell, she claimed that homosexuality is an evil spirit and that homosexuality is a perverted act. Well, Ellen has now responded and said, okay, cool, you're not on the show anymore. So they have canceled her appearance on the show. Now, a lot of people are saying, well, why don't you support free speech? We do support free speech. Pastor Kim Burrell, singer Kim Burrell, you can do things like this. You can say these horribly homophobic things in your sermons. Nobody's stopping you from doing that. Oh, by the way, also, pastor, singer, Kim Burrell, there are effects to that. This is one of the effects. You don't get to be on the Ellen Show anymore. People are expressing surprise. Ellen is all about free speech. Yeah, sorry, I'm not expressing a lot of surprise that pastor, singer, Kim Burrell, who said these horribly homophobic things, was dropped from the Ellen Show. Sorry, no, not a surprise. So to be clear, yes, absolutely, free speech, yay. Also, there are effects to that. And one of them, you don't get to be on the Ellen Show. Sorry, not gonna happen. Microsoft founder Bill Gates' charity foundation has invested a vast amount of funding to research HIV-preventing drug implants. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is providing up to $140 million in funding for the groundbreaking new technology, which could revolutionize HIV prevention. At the moment, just to remind you all, prevention drugs are available as a pill that, if taken daily, can vastly reduce a person's chances of being infected with HIV. And I say that as a reminder because there are any number of healthcare professionals, there's a lot of research out there right now, that healthcare professionals absolutely do not know about these pills, much less are recommending them to their LGBTQ clients or to any clients whatsoever. And so we have to do a lot more education. The drugs are recommended by the World Health Organization for use by at-risk groups, including men who have sex with men, but are only effective if the pills are taken consistently. And also, I want to remind people, they only target HIV. They do not target other STIs. So anyone who's out there saying, oh, I take PrEP, and that protects me from all STIs, sexually transmitted infections, you get to say no. First of all, we need to inform your healthcare provider that they're not doing as much education as they should be doing. But also, no, they don't do that. They prevent HIV. Well, ahead of large-scale trials of PrEP implants, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has entered into a relationship with a pharma company called Intarsia Therapeutics to research and develop the technology. It has pledged $50 million towards the initial project, with a further $90 million of funding tied to milestone goals and a commitment to further development grants if they are successful. Sue Desmond-Hellman, the CEO of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, said this, quote, "There's a vital need for HIV and AIDS intervention that allows those at risk to incorporate prevention more easily into their daily lives. We feel optimistic about our partnership with Intarsia and the prospect of an implantable prophylactic device that could make a world of difference for people most in need." Very exciting news there. I don't really want to talk that much about Milo Yiannopoulos, even though I acknowledge, hey, that's one of the biggest LGBTQ stories out there. So yes, alt-right, internet, troll, not a good guy, Milo Yiannopoulos, who I don't even think believes half of what comes out of his mouth. He just knows that it gets him attention, and here I am giving him more attention on my rinky-dinky little gay show. Yes, he got a $250,000 book deal from an imprint from Simon & Schuster, and people are outraged all over the place, and people want to boycott. I don't know. I actually am for free speech. I'm also for, in some ways, a free market where we say, hey, no, folks, don't buy this book. There's no way we're going to be able to prevent Milo from publishing his book. That's not the way the world works. We are now in a self-publishing age. If it wasn't going to be this imprint, which, by the way, is an extremely conservative imprint, they publish any number of offensive and anti-LGBT publications out there. So if it wasn't going to be this imprint, it was going to be a self-published book. It was going to get out there, but we don't need to be spending any money buying it. Well, Lambda Literary, which is one of the biggest LGBTQ consortiums out there for all things literary and all things gay, they put out a statement. They said this, quote, "Last week, the white supremacist Milo Yiannopoulos, notorious for his misogynistic, transphobic, homophobic, and racist rants, announced he had signed a $250,000 book deal with the Simon & Schuster imprint Threshold Editions. While publishers undeniably have the right to acquire and profit from any book they wish, they also bear an essential responsibility to promote civil discourse and reject hate speech that is often a precursor to violence. Even as publishers tout the diversity of voices they publish, they should not enable the work of a writer whose diatribes bludgeon women, transgender people, queer people, people of color, or anyone else. We at Lambda Literary stand with the diverse writers and readers who believe that for a publisher to give this writer money and a megaphone is an affront on the values we all share." So there you go. I mean, I agree with every single word of that. I guess in some ways, I'm a little bit more of a realist. This book was going to get out there no matter what. And we didn't get word of, hey, he might get $250,000. It already happened. This has already taken place. And so I think that Simon & Schuster sees all of this internet outcry and says, awesome, cool, we made the right decision here. This is absolutely going to generate sales. He was trending on Twitter when this news came out, and he's banned from Twitter. Trending on Twitter, a guy who was banned from Twitter. So I think the real solution at this point in the process is to not buy the book. Do not spend any money on the book. If you are connected with a bookstore, tell them, we don't want the book here. That's fine. But it probably will get there. Don't spend any money on it. And if you see anyone holding it, maybe have a conversation with them. Maybe don't be verbally assaultive, because that's not what we recommend doing, but have a conversation with them. Leslie Jones, who was really one of the reasons that Milo was banned from Twitter, not Leslie Jones herself, the horrible, horrible things he and his followers said to her, she most definitely put out a tweet that said, hey, maybe don't endorse spreading hate out there. So we absolutely agree with Leslie Jones. Folks, do not spend money on this. Okay? Don't do it. And that, my friends, is all the time we have left for this week's episode of This Show Is So Gay. Again, a happy new year to you. Get out there. Go use your voice the way you know how to use it to make a difference for your LGBTQ brothers and sisters, for all of those allies out there. And while you're out there making a difference, while you're out there using your voice, please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?